So the way we like to start is to have you identify yourself, please, because this is indeed radio.
Right.
And not television. Thank goodness.
Because I didn't do my hair today.
We're not going to get into mine. We'll just leave that. And let us know we have the right person in the room.
Okay. My name's Roger O'Donnell, and I'm here at KUSF.
Wow. Call letters in, because it's on the microphone, right?
90.3 FM.
Oh, thank you. We'll do the ID later. So this was an interesting thing, because, you know, you get an email from the publicist and they say, Roger O'Donnell. I said, really? What's he doing? And they say, you know, you're going to go for this. So this project started, and some of these are going to be obvious questions, but since I read a lot of interviews, but my listeners probably have not heard this interview before. If they have, then there's a real problem with a time-space continuum. We better do something about that. It started with composition of one song for a film about Bob Moog, right?
Yeah.
And the audience probably doesn't know the story, so can you tell the version of that?
3 years ago now, I approached Moog to have some kind of artist relationship with them. You know, kind of a two-way thing where I would have input into their instruments and they would give me cheap stuff. One of those good relationships.
One of them tricks. Right.
And they were very happy and very excited to work with me. And I was very flattered, of course, because I've been a fan of Moog since the 70s. And it's a hugely influential company. And Bob was an incredible inventor and designer of electronics and innovator. So they said to me, oh, they're making a film. There's these two guys, Ryan Page and Hans Fjellstad, who are making a documentary about Bob, and they're putting a soundtrack together. And you should talk to them. Maybe they'd want you to have a song on the soundtrack. So indeed I did. And they asked me, and I was very excited. And I went home with my brand new Voyager. And
you were hooked.
Yes, exactly. And I thought, as a tribute to Bob and to his instruments, I would try and write a song composed entirely and recorded and written and played. To leave out any word there, written, recorded, composed. On the Voyager.
Executed.
Executed, yeah, I did execute it.
I was going to say, though, maybe that's not the best word, but sorry.
So I built it up. Kind of like I used to in the old days when I had very limited instrumentation. I knew that I could make a bass line. I knew that I could make kind of string kind of sounds. And then I thought, well, let's see how it progresses. And one thing that after all the years of using multi-timbral, in that you can play more than one sound at the same time, instruments, going back to this instrument, which literally only plays one note and one sound at a time, you can't layer it with MIDI. It kind of took me aback at first. And then I realized that everything that I played, I kind of had to commit to and then just build on top of it.
I don't think people really realize, of course, if they go to your website and see the collection, that there are so many different kinds of Moog synthesizers. You know, I think they know about Switched On Bach.
Yeah.
You know, because that's become the, you know,
the go-to.
The poster child for. Yeah. But he really didn't just make he really did some crazy things.
And what he did for a performance with a Moog was most important. In the 60s, synthesizers were huge things, huge combinations of modules that weren't hardwired, and you would literally patch one to another, and it was difficult, if not impossible, to take one on the road. And what Bob did was to choose the most useful of those modules and put them into one instrument, which he called the Mini. It wasn't very mini, it was quite big, but compared to the modulars, it was huge. And then after that, he progressed and he made, usually people make a budget version and then they make one that plays two notes and then one that plays eight notes. And so over the years, and then he lost the name for quite some time, for about 20 years, and other people were making things in his name. So there were quite a few models, probably 10 maybe. So.
Wow. And Bjork and her one album, was an influence on this project, because she didn't have a Moog, she just had a voice.
Exactly. And I like to say that with the Voyager, I found my voice. I found something that I could articulate, something that could speak for me musically. I don't sing, and I've got luckily no intention of ever singing. But I just thought of her bravery of doing that album with just her voice and exposing herself so entirely. That inspired me and gave me the confidence to pursue the idea of just using the Voyager, the Moog Voyager, as my voice. And I love Björk too much, really. Sometimes I listen to her and just feel like giving up, because she's so perfect that I don't think I can come close. But I get over that.
You know, I talked to her today. No, just kidding. Yeah. She said the same about you. It's incredible.
Yeah, we got a great relationship.
I imagine in the composing phase there was more than a fair amount of experimentation, finding sounds that appealed, building a song around that sound, but certainly not sounds that are in any way, shape, or form tried and true.
No. When the synthesizer first came out, it was hailed as an instrument that you could use to model real instruments, that you could use to make a flute sound or a trumpet. And indeed we did in those days. And indeed most of them were horrible and nasty. And synthesizers in general can sound pretty nasty and cheesy in the wrong hands. And what I intended to do was to treat it in its own right as an instrument and give it the respect that I thought it deserved, and try and, my main aim was to make it sound organic, and the music that I created to be emotional. Those are the two key words for me. And each day when I would start to write a song, well, I wouldn't go into the studio with the intention of writing a song. I just went in there and I would just fool around with the Moog, just discovering sounds, until one came up that I thought was cool, and also that it suggested a melody or a rhythm or some kind of sequence. And then the song would grow immediately from that and very quickly. So it would start with one sound.
And I read that, and of course you've had to now create this now once you figured out how to do this live.
Yeah.
But prior to doing that, I read in an interview that you regret you didn't save some of the sounds so they could be created or used again at a later point, which of course
it's been
then
quite
you
difficult.
Realized you wanted to take this out to places, and next thing you know, you're there rediscovering the world.
Yeah, that was quite tricky. My creative process is quite mercurial, and I was actually discussing it the other day, and I think of the Voyager as my kind of paint palette, where I mix colors that are sounds. And part of the process is when you do a painting and you mix a very nice green, you don't then say, oh, I'll mix a bit more of that and I'll put that to one side so I can use it later. And also the ideas come to me very quickly, and just the 5-10 seconds it takes to save a sound would interfere with the process too much. So I didn't save any of the sounds. And also I was talking to the musician that's touring with us, Christopher Willits, and he said, yeah, of course, if you don't use the paint quick enough, it dries up. So that was another really nice analogy that I thought. And so I've gone back and I've tried to recreate those sounds. If you look at using the color analogy again, if you look at a color, a nice green, you think, oh yeah, that's three parts yellow and two parts blue. But you can't ever get the same color again. I've actually discovered a lot more about the instrument going back to it.
But doesn't that make it interesting? Because now when you're playing this live, people are not hearing
exactly,
a precise copy of the record.
Yeah, it's not a facsimile at all. And it was very important to me that I didn't play the songs the same every night, that they would start with the same kind of structure and the same melodies, but there would be a huge amount of room for interpretation. I've spent too much of my career playing in groups where we would play the same song exactly the same night after night. And I just don't think that that's art. And I'm lucky enough to be in a position in my career where I can concentrate on the art and let the commerciality take care of itself.
What a concept. Your choice of vocalist was inspired. You knew her from the Cure days, did you not?
Erin, who's sitting to my left.
Yes, Erin, come on, pull up a microphone for crying. Erin thinks she was thinking that she was going to get away with this with me. And the second that she showed up in the taxi cab, unfortunately,
that's it.
You have to share the wealth a little bit. So that's why I did it. You see, the question was written, the choice of Erin Lang.
Yeah.
But of course, I had to say your choice of vocalist just so we could do a little bit of embarrassment there. Just to see if you turned around and said, oh yes, she.
We'd been working together on Erin's...
It's since the Cure days,
yeah,
right?
On Erin's music. I'd been kind of producing Erin's music. And of course, I loved her voice because we'd been working for so long. And when I was working on the record, it was primarily instrumental. And I thought that instrumental albums can often be exclusive in the sense that they exclude. And when you add a vocal, it makes it more human and invites listeners in and makes it... it's just a way in. And she saved the computer from going out the window about two or three times.
Yeah. You don't want to throw antiques out the window. You know, I mean, if you want to go, you want to go to the Riot House in L.A. and
yeah, I've been there many times.
Yes, I know you well. Yes, and you want to just throw things out the window, but not the not the synthesizer. No, okay, but tell me, how familiar were you with the sound of this lovely instrument that you were suddenly having your voice put upon? And tell me about the process. Did Roger give you the melodies and then you wrote the lyrics? Was it the Rogers and Moog?
Yeah, Rogers and Moog. It was
Gilbert and Voyager.
Yeah. It was an interesting process, and it was really different for me because I'd never really worked like that before, or in the way that Roger had intended, because he did have all the melodies in his mind already and a lot of the lyrics. But I think also maybe Roger being a little less used to writing lyrics and putting melodies, it was a process of fitting things in and making it all kind of work together. And then we were also lucky with the sound. I wasn't familiar at all, really, with most of the synth world before I met Roger. And then the sound of the Moog is so rich. And I didn't think about it at the time, but since then we've looked back and thought, oh, we're lucky that my voice did fit, because I think, thinking of other voices...
Your voice has multi-timbres to it.
Though, right.
Which probably helped the process along, too.
Yeah, it was... And I hear things very much only one way. So I heard the vocal melodies, and it was quite difficult for Erin in the sense that she didn't have much room to change the melody, because I could only hear it one way, especially with it being coming on top of such of the music that was already fully written.
Mm-hmm.
But she worked out the harmonies, and she really helped with the lyrics, where usually I come up with the first two lines and then they rhyme and then that's it, goes down.
Moon, June, tune. Yeah. Thank you very much.
And that's it. And I'm like, well, we're going to need something else to rhyme with moon or reverb, you know, look
at it. But it was a good process. And
it was actually like easy for me in one way, because when I'm writing my own music, I second guess everything. I have to think about it for a month. But with Roger, it was like, nope, this is it. And it was done in an hour.
You were
hour.
Given a template,
exactly.
To say the least. But once there was a basic recording, you still did a lot of with the output in the mix.
Throughout the process of recording, because I recorded it at home in my own studio, I felt, and also because of the using one instrument for the whole thing, I thought that it would be best if I gave it to somebody else to mix it, a professional that knew how to deal with the frequencies of the Moog, somebody that... you knew how to put compressors on things and limiters and just make it sound right. So I started looking, all the time I was recording, I had the idea that I was going to let somebody else mix it. We didn't use very many effects on it. And I recorded everything dry without effects.
Yeah, you really didn't. There's not much. I mean, I listened to that first track, and it's very flat. In fact, for people who are used to hearing highs in certain things...
Oh, yeah, highs.
That first track is like...
Yeah, the person who we took it to mix it, his name is Mario Thaler. He's a producer in Germany. And I went to him for several reasons. First of all, I love his work. He produced The No Twist, Lali Puna, and another band called Ms. John Soda. He's part of this incredibly creative scene in southern Germany. So I loved his sound. And also, the German music culture is so tied in with electronic music. I just thought it was taking it home and that he would understand the music and how to work with electronic music. But like you were saying with the frequencies, I tend to use with the Voyager, I keep the filter closed, which keeps a lot, loses a lot of the top end, a lot of the high frequencies. And he was going crazy trying to get some top
Trying to get something in there that's not there.
Yeah, and there's not there.
It's like there's nothing again above 5,000 hertz. So no, I'm sorry, isn't. Sir, it doesn't exist.
No, so you can't put it there if it's not there.
he's trying to turn it all. Yeah. It's like there's nothing. It's just
nothing
like,
there.
That's all there is.
Yeah.
For those who keep listening after the last song, and it's funny because I read about this, and then I was in the car last night, and I'm fast forwarding. You've given sort of a bonus sound, bonus soundscape, and it's a couple of minutes out.
Yeah,
it's a ways out, so it's kind of fun for the people who are, you know, who are just listening and they're doing other things,
yeah.
And there they are in their living room or in their kitchen and they're hanging out, yeah. And next thing you know, there's something special going
on. The idea came to me a long time ago, in I think 1972 or around that time. Jack Bruce, the bass player from The Cream. The cream, whatever.
Well, you know, they could have been The Cream.
Yeah, I like calling everything The.
I think that, well, you know, from that era, they really should have been The Cream.
Yeah, they should.
They had some nerve. Well, Jefferson Airplane, they really had some nerve not putting a The.
Yeah.
How dare they? Hello, Jack. Listen, Eric, we've got a problem here.
He had a solo album called Harmony Row, and at the end of it, and at the end of the last song, he pours a glass of water. And you hear him drinking it, and he breathes a sigh. And I just thought it was really, it really took you into the studio. And because the Voyager isn't in any way or any sense an acoustic instrument, it comes out of it and it goes straight into the recording system. There's no room around it, there's no space. And I thought it would be nice just to put it into a space at the end of the record. And whenever I've finished in the studio, I come back into the house, put BBC Radio 4 on, put the kettle on, and have a cup of tea, which pretty much bookends the whole English way of life, which I'm sure most people know anyway. We don't do anything without a cup of tea before it, in the middle of it, and then after.
In the grand tradition of the era that you come from, whether it be the Psych Furs or the Cure, there's some pretty nifty remixes that have already gone on here. Some pretty interesting people have.
Yeah, I thought it was a great record. There's not much percussion on it. Any percussion on it was also generated by the Moog. So there's a lot of space, and I thought it was an ideal album to have remixes done. And I've got over the last couple of years a few very favourite people in that kind of remix area. And I thought, what have I got to lose? I'll just send them an email.
And see what they do.
See what they say. And you know what?
But what great fodder for a remix.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, to give them a nice, nice plate of stuff to play with,
yeah.
You know, it's. I would imagine it's way too tempting.
Yeah.
But, and yet, this record was not made specifically to get a lot of typical radio airplay.
It wasn't made with anything in mind, actually. In fact, after the show last night, I was talking to some friends saying, you know, I was sitting in my studio at home, I made this music, and now I've just played in San Francisco. I played
it live.
How strange
is this?
It's such an incredible chain of events, and so unlikely, because I did literally just make the music for myself. I didn't have any preconceptions or ideas about commerciality. I just made the record, and I've been very, very lucky that I've found people that believe in it and that have been prepared to get behind it. It took a long time for me to get a deal, but the people that I'm with are incredible.
I just read your top five synth albums, and Talking Book by Stevie Wonder was quite the surprise.
Yeah.
So I pulled it out last night, and I sat down, and I was like, when you hear a Stevie Wonder, when you hear so many, I mean, some of them are, you know, we hear a Vangelis record, well, you know,
synth.
You know that it's synth. When you hear a Depeche Mode record, you know that it's synth. But Stevie Wonder was an inspired thing because you think of him more with the Motown sound and the horns and the bass guitar and all of that.
He was a huge influence, has always been a huge influence on my playing because of his emotion. And also the timing on those records. When I started making this record, I made a conscious decision not to use sequencing and to play everything live, and therefore let the timing be looser. You listen to Talking Book, and it's just fluid and human. And the synthesizers on there are just incredible. I think that's a huge area of synth music that's been overlooked, and how influential it was. And in fact, Moogs are a huge part of hip-hop and R&B again. So it's nice it's come around again. You know, I find it distressing that the face of synthesizers is Rick Wakeman and Keith Emerson. I think they've done huge disservices to the instrument. I know I'll be lynched by the prog rock crowd, but I've never been a fan of prog. It's so cold and all about flash and showing off and the opposite of what I think music is.
We have this little trademark we call a musical sandwich, and I think you are going to have a lot of fun with this, and you're definitely, Aaron, going to join in. We pick two of your songs as the bread, and then we put as many fillings in between from other bands and artists that you want to go with this.
I'd like the first track to be the title track, which I think if I had to play, if anybody has to be turned on to the record, it should be the title track, because that sums it up for me. And if anybody only got to hear one track, that would be the one that I would. And the last track has to be the bottom of the sandwich. And if we're going to go with the middle, then it should be Aaron singing on This Grey Morning. So that's The Truth of Me is the first piece of bread. This Grey Morning is in the middle, and So I Close My Eyes is at the end. And immediately before And So I Close My Eyes should be something from Band of Gypsies, because that's kind of what I thought of, that Hendrix playing into the open air. Well, that wasn't an open air, but that combination. And the Band of Gypsies was such a free period, I think, for him musically. So I think, Machine Gun.
Okay.
So Machine
Very
Gun
cool.
from Band of Gypsies before And So I Close My Eyes.
Okay.
And after The Truth in Me, I think it would be nice to have Stevie Wonder song. Any thoughts, Aaron?
For the Stevie Wonder song?
Yeah.
Aaron was so busy thinking of hers.
Yeah, exactly.
Stevie from, probably from Talking Book. You can choose that one, Dennis.
Okay. I'll just kind of close my eyes and...
Something really groovy.
Okay, I think we can find... I think on Talking Book there are a few groovy tunes,
yeah,
to say the least.
And before and after yours?
I would think before Grey Morning. I love Mazzy Star and her vocal... You know, there's such a piece to her vocals, and I kind of was thinking that, so maybe Fade Into You.
Sure.
That's good. And after it, I think we should have a Frank Zappa song, because there's a... There's a nod to Frank in that song, because after Jimi Hendrix, Frank Zappa took me through my whole musical experience. He opened my eyes to everything. I owe him a huge debt. So Frank should be directly after that, because there's a nod in there, and if anybody can spot it, they should tell me.
Okay, you've got to give me a Zappa song.
Yeah.
Give me something.
That works for me too, because I love the crazy girl backing vocals that he had
right,
on so many.
Right.
Just
yeah,
the
he
car.
Did.
Great.
Well, this is going to be a weird show.
Yeah.
That's the whole point.
There's a song on the Grand Wazoo called Eat That Question.
There you go.
That would be cool after that.
Sounds terrific.
And what about... So are we getting, it's getting quite full, isn't it?
Well, we have room for another slice or two of lettuce and tomato.
Yeah.
You know, and Aaron can add some, no, it's terrible. I was going to say he can add some cheese, but I don't know if that's, I don't know if I really want to make you responsible for the cheese, because he already did the Frank Zappa, so.
What about some watermelon in there?
Okay.
Herbie Hancock Watermelon Man, that was cheesy.
The Herbie Hancock version of Watermelon Man, okay. Yeah. That's cool.
For something a little more
contemporary, am I giving my age away?
That's okay.
Something from the Bjork album.
Oh yeah, Medulla. Something from Medulla. Yeah. Where's the line in me? Triumph of the Heart.
There we go.
Bjork. It's a fun. Yeah. Good. Fun.
You can put that wherever you like.
Okay. So anything else you want to throw a couple of more in? Just wild cards, just because there's stuff you've always just wanted to play on the radio and you.
Oh, that D'Antel song. What's that called?
Anyone Anywhere, I think it's
Anyone
called.
Anywhere from the Life is Full of Possibilities. Oh. Jimmy Tamborella. I'm a huge fan. He DJed for us
very
for the
cool.
show in LA. And he's just such an incredibly talented guy. And he's done wonders for electronic music in mainstream American pop. And we owe him a big... although it took him to him the other night. He's not sure how he did it. Although, are any of us ever sure how anything ever happens? You know, he's as bemused by success as anybody else is. But that is such an incredible song with Mia singing on it. Mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty good sandwich.